Colonel Sir David Thorne, Reel 11. I think you're saying that you could get...
Eight people into the back of the APC, the 432, and of course then the commander and a driver. So I suppose you're talking about a complement of 10, of which the core of this little section commander who's up top, and seven below, and one man who would then make sure that the vehicle got to its sort of legal and so on. And then your command vehicles, or platoon commander, your company commander's vehicles, and the sergeant major in one of the other company headquarters vehicles, they would have people like signals, extra signals, and so on. So they weren't so crammed full of people, but they carried out certain sort of important functions of communication and command and control. And tucked into that also, the whole issue of ammunition we supply, so our major was in charge of that. You know, so that it was like all the principles of the infantry company on the ground, but also applicable to the 432. You move much faster, and if the 432 didn't work in sufficient numbers, then you rapidly, in other words, maintenance and keeping a vehicle on the road absolutely critical to the effectiveness of your unit.
Who was responsible for that day-to-day routine
an
maintenance?
Each company, and a strong MT complement in terms of the MT platoon at battalion headquarters. Your MT sergeant, my guy, Sergeant Clark, with a lovely man, you know, came back from the Falklands. I think they're going to have a very high profile time down in the Falklands. And I remember him bringing me this lovely figure of Britannia carved in this black metal, and with from so you know that's an aside, but it's how you keep in touch with all your friends, so to speak. And he was the MT sergeant and the MT corporal and a little Remy detachment. And they were very important to us, and they set standards. And I also used them, weaponry, very important, which are small arms, and all your weapons, very highest order. And I think I may have mentioned last time we spoke of my, the strength of my feelings about that when I was battalion commander in Cyprus. Funny enough, I told my son about this, because he's just getting out to Cyprus to command. One of the companies in the 2nd Battalion, I said to him that I'd had, sorry, this is a real digression, but it comes back to my real conviction that, you know, the soldier looks after his head, his feet, his hands, his ability to communicate, his fitness to march, and you know, he's got to think quickly, and his weapon has to be absolutely wedded to the man and to be really efficient. And I remember that we had a beyond local capacity with the 250 of the weapons in the battalion, but it was not function of horse construction. You know, there's people in Cyprus going berserk. But I was right, I didn't know right, and now they were back in the commander days, absolutely right hand men, if I like to say. Because they set these critical standards which we didn't know enough about.
What were the standard small arms you were using?
We were using that time. The self-loading rifles, the SLR.
Because previously you'd been using the Lee-Enfield, hadn't you? Yes. What did you think of the SLR compared to the Lee-Enfield number 4?
Well, it's a simple reality. It's faster. You want to keep it clean, you get all that. But it's got a shorter barrel, and so it's more difficult to fire it accurately.
Also, it's gas operated, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And there are complications with stoppages, which you wouldn't have with the bolt action.
The weapon would come back to the maintenance of the weapon, absolutely fundamental. You know, when you compare the clashing pot with the self-loading rifle, there's no comparison. You can blend the clashing pot through the dirt, and it's still the fire. than the SAR, or the SA-80 even more, through the dirt and following around, and that's it.
But the Kalashnikov doesn't have the hitting power and the range or accuracy of the...
Absolutely. So if you come back to Gorkowitz and the balance of our advantage. Lighter tank, faster moving, smaller gun, more maneuverable, more difficult to hit, get places faster, can outmaneuver. But when it gets there, if it's up against these header armed tanks, you can kill it from a very range, and those tanks are handled with style, then it's a loser.
What about your 4.32? What sort of fire could that keep out?
Small arms fire.
From any range?
I think effectively, yes. We were certainly told that was so. But I think the moment you get into twelve millimeter round or cannon round, things like that, then you're right on the edge of the thing going straight through. And anything bigger than that.
And what about shell splinter? Would it keep out?
Sometimes, like all these things, you know, it's a matter of proportion and velocity. And I don't know enough about the mechanics of that. But it was a good vehicle to give you confidence that you would turn the battle, and as you were closing with the enemy behind your armour, and they were using small arms, you got a very good chance of getting away with it. And smoke canisters, it would project smoke, and you've got a GPMG mounted up top, which gave you something to fire with as you went in.
Did you carry a squad machine gun with every section?
Every section, absolutely.
They had the GPMG.
Come back to the most important weapon, to my mind, you have your fire group and you have your attacking group in every section, and I spend more time training GPMG gunners and reserves. I had it's a company list always based on fitness and ability to shoot, ability to communicate, and as far as shooting is concerned, it the GPMG gunner who is critical and he's number two. And to be a GPMG gunner in A company one way, and then he was high honor, and everybody knew it. And of course, I go back to when I was a private soldier. And what I was the smallest guy in the section, one of the women to give me to carry, but the light machine gun, and I had it as well. In my time, as a company commander, the critical thing was the guts of the guy and his ability to shoot. If nobody had a good shot, who's frightened, or who hasn't got physical strength and hasn't got will. You've got to find these people over length of time. You don't just pick them out like that. And so, a properly organized and trained company is a distillation of experience, and in which people gain a reputation for being excellent at first aid, excellent at communicating, excellent at GPMG gunner, excellent at seeing at night and hearing very well, excellent at staying cool when others are getting excited, good at digging. Everyone has that, and in a sense, a good cover commander and his team, the sergeant major. They can make that instrument sing. And then the instrument responds to the company commander, each one an individual. And you gain a sense of very high confidence and therefore resilience. And you need that, because when you lose one, that confidence seeps away. And the company with the greatest confidence that will last the longest can survive the longest. And that is a distillation of understanding of the people in that company. And that comes from working hard with them and challenging them and getting them sometimes to be friends and getting them sometimes to be go through extremes of effort and gradually, but to do it so well judged that you don't break people, that you always build them.
Now, you're saying that you had a good rate of retention in the battalion generally, because this sort of training and selecting process, which is obviously simultaneous, must take some time.
Yes.
But how long did your soldiers normally serve? What was the sort of usual average term of service for them?
I wish I could remember what I said, but I think we're talking about 3, 6, 9. And I can't remember the percentages. I could probably dig around in my I've still got my folder for my Cup of Commander. I'm going to have a look for that. I'll have a little note at the end, isn't it? See if I can dig it out for the next time we meet. Because I'm pretty sure I've got that. I've certainly got my notebook. As a brigade commander and as commander of forces in Auckland and the GLC. Whether I've got my battalion notebook, I'm not sure, but I certainly got some very good material. I've bring some of this material down. It's a really, we're now coming out of the area where I've actually got material, a lot of it. Somebody's written up. And so we can look at that and say, right, what do we want to draw upon? It's rather like a company commander's understanding of his company, it's rather like a platoon commander's understanding of his platoon. It's done on a notebook, it's done on knowing a lot about all the men. And based on knowing their drinking habits as well as their working habits. It's based upon them greatly obtaining trust. I think the first time a company commander becomes of real value is about 3 months in. And then after 6 months, if he hasn't got a complete understanding of his people, when he's been under. And from then on, he can gradually mould them and move them and place them and develop them. When he's between commanding him, he's kind of saying they're doing their team sergeants. And he can build the young talent in among the NCOs in a way that means that by the second year, that's a company which really takes a beating if he's a good company commander.
But then he moves on.
But then you move on, exactly. And life has to move on, doesn't it? Mm. So that's one of the problems. I actually think my happiest times in the army, and the happiest times of my life, were platoon commander and a single platoon commander. And a single platoon commander, I really knew both my role and my people. They knew me. And we had enormous confidence in each other. The same as a company commander.
Well, there's some of the same soldiers still there. Yeah. When you join, they'd moved on, had they?
And what really happens is, as a company commander, I produced soldiers as NCOs who then became at the top of the battalion in the next two generations, so to speak. And then, as a battalion commander, I produced people there, consequently backwards, who really were dominant contributors within the regiment for the next 15, 20 years. It's all about training systems.
How much freedom did you have to devise your own training systems and methods within the battalion framework?
A certain amount, but then you had to have, you were set targets by the brigade corps, and the battalion commander was extremely able, and he expected to test you. They're very excellent tests, run by one officer. And they're only made good as not.
What sort of test did he impose?
Well, the first test went in November after 3.5 months with master contact. Every company to join the master contact and perform. And of course, the battalion commander could. You had your the gunners, you had the tanks, you had the full proper battle group. And you had people monitoring your net, tactical situation developing that you had to respond to. You came out absolutely run dry in terms of effort, but extremely good at testing you in that sort of warfare.
This was company by company?
Company by company. Mm. Mm. All the same test. So the commander has to complain about the results.
And did you find that the reading you'd done when you were at Cromwell had a direct and practical value when you were actually running your company?
Funnily enough, that was not so much the value. The real value was in the talking shop of the British Army, the one. And you met the slightly contentious. There were a lot of BAR warriors there who thought you'd just come from a born in the middle and you knew nothing. And I knew things they didn't know. had read books they hadn't read, and I moved so quickly, and others are coming, and another company too, in the merchant, moved so quickly to grasp the essentials and then to actually shift to the forefront in terms of that expression. So the Gorkowitz and Fuller, Little Heart, were being used by other people who'd read them, that I had read them to, and the Gorkowitz, not many of them have read. So, in a sense, it gave me a great deal of confidence in anybody's company. Mm. And that was useful. It saved me time worrying about that. I can really control the company and what, you know, make the model work.
Was the company up to strength? Do you have a full... How many chaps did you have?
20.
And you had a full complement of officers as well?
Yes.
Mm. And did you get to know every individual soldier during this process of team building and training?
Certainly, but some much better than others. And who were they? They were either the key people like the deep energy fellows, the drivers were critically important. In that field, of course, the section commanders were absolutely fundamental. They were so much more influential and could pop things up so much more thoroughly.
Well, if you're advancing in section packages, obviously.
Absolutely. Well, what you're doing is if there's one vehicle that's not answering up when you want things shifted, it slows everybody up. If there's one APC that constantly gets lost, you know, it's like that. In a sense, you stood and fell much more quickly in mechanizing it than you did in, I think, in the slow moving, but sometimes physically much more demanding.
And how many APCs did you actually have in the company?
20.
What was your personal vehicle like? How did you have it fitted up and organised?
You had a conventional radio fit, and then you organised it to suit your minus of the disinterested.
What did you put into yours? cricket bat?
No, I did take cricket bat. To be quite clear, and I had a good company, and I didn't have a second command for quite some time, but basically on occasion I was playing for the British Army alone, and we were deploying on exercise as the game was second day, and so the commanding officer had to put me to play and get the company out the field. Well, I said fine, and I got over the senior sergeant, which I thought Peter Williamson, and said, "You took out good weapons with the company, and coming from here." And so, literally, I had came in a cricket kit, all my kit was on the ABC, I changed into it, after that. Proper duty. And the way it should be.
So, in your command vehicle, it was effectively a command vehicle, wasn't it?
Yeah. So, you've got your signals, you've got three command vehicles.
Yes. This is company headquarters.
And so company was the main command vehicle. The number two was second in command, who you wanted to make sure didn't get, who wanted to get the thing, who didn't get rubbed out, who got rubbed out, so to speak. So he was in the UN. You normally, in advance of contact, were right up behind the leading platoon, and your second command vehicle were back. And the sergeant major with him, and also ammunition was the power, so we had to come forward with ammunition.
So you'd have a sort of left out of battle cadre?
That would be the theory, and that would be an air shell.
Yes.
But we didn't run that sort of thing, because basically we wanted to get everybody up there and train. But I think if the balloon had started to develop, we'd have started to practice that.
Besides, you said you had the standard radio fit in your vehicle. What other furniture and equipment did it have to serve your requirements?
Because you're fitted with grids inside, cages inside. And you had cages which you fitted outside. So you put something that didn't matter outside, the sort of solid thing. So you obviously carried water, you carried food, you carried ammunition, and used a constant practice, the packing of the ammunition, everything like that. We were very professional about them, we knew exactly what we were doing, exactly where the ammunition was, and get to call out, and we used to get called out, and it was exactly what we had and what we needed. But it was your food, your water, your ammunition, then your clothing.
And this was a standard
medical.
This was a standard 4-3-2 that you were in. What about things like map tables and things like that?
You had those.
What? How many people would there actually be with you in your command vehicle?
I recall, yourself, quite probably your support platoon commander, two signals, driver, and somebody basically support for the moment. So five or six.
When the time came for the company to debus, because it had bumped and made contact, did you debus with it, or would you wouldn't have?
Straight up.
How would you then maintain control? Did you have a man-pack radio?
And when it comes to man-pack control, I had a radio, but what I practiced also was, and instilled in the officers, basically the officers carried the radio. I carried my radio. I carried that. And that's what I instilled in my battalion. The critical thing is communication. So your radio operator is there to pick up the radio when you go again and go run and charge. But otherwise, all the communication is like that, either on the machine or on foot, is between officers and senior NCOs who are absolutely switched on, and they exactly have control of other people around them, and they have immediate communication. So there's no business of the operator chatting around and getting a message and half and getting garbled and so on. Lethal. Just like all the officers carried rifles. I carried a rifle, never carried a pistol in my life. As a battalion commander, and a brigade commander, and a division commander, rifle. The stupidity of carrying pistols, which fits you out anyway as an officer. Why get knocked off? And why be unable to knock somebody else off? Because all you do is pick a little weapon, in which most officers do themselves an injury.
It sounds like you don't regard the pistol as a practical weapon.
No.
Now, you're saying that the important thing was to debus at the right moment, and for the taxi cabs, the battle cabs to go back. Was there any thought at that time of using the 4-3-2 as a base of fire support after debussing? Was that an idea that was under discussion at the time, that the APC should perhaps accompany the men on foot to shoot them in?
It was the sort of thing that would be considered as always an option, but I think once you're debused, you're taking a heavy risk with slowish moving, rather large armored personnel carrier with a very small weapon on top. What are you getting? They're going to lose more than you're getting. So you're not getting the people would be particularly happy with the poor. I think in fact the battalion said you wanted to do it very comfortable.
When you're doing an advanced contact, what sort of formation would the company be in, and where would your place be within it? You said behind the leading platoon normally, or just behind the leading platoon.
Right, but you're going to have, depending on the country, you're going to have the reconnaissance vehicles and preferably as a company, your armour as in front of you, right? Together with the leading platoon, so it's a very strong group up front, with recce well in front. Right?
What would the recce vehicles be? Would they be light?
They would be armoured reconnaissance vehicles.
So it would be.
It could be that they would be the recce from the recce platoon of the battalion.
Yes.
But that was never so good as the Army Corps, because simply the vehicles that were called were second. I know they weren't. We had some sort of gun. We had first scout cars and we had first scout cars. Bloody dangerous vehicles.
Why are they dangerous?
Together.
Oh. And what would the armoured recce have?
I well remember, after being a fortnight in Germany, the signal officer attached was killed with the fake scout car every time. And in Cyprus, there was a couple of them in the town tonight. They lost people with the fake scout car.
What about the Armoured Corps? Would their vehicle, but this is too early for the Scimitar, isn't it? Or
yeah, I can't remember what the hell they were.
Would they be light tanks or armoured cars? Do you remember with the wheeled or tracked?
Basically, you had the recce element of the armoured regiment would have been some form of scout car. I can't remember that. Then you only come into direct contact, which you have to do, in a sense, is move as rapidly and as safely as possible, and probably on more than one axis, because the moment one axis is blocked, you put on the other, and thereby you disrupt them and suffer, and then go just up on one. And so you might have you might have one up, but two back on other tracks you've got with the wind, so that as soon as one was stopped, you didn't push up the other, because it means you go on the flex. In a sense, you've got an extremely flexible instrument, both within the company combat team and in the battle group, to develop all the time.
Who is in overall command of the battle group? Would that be the armoured commander or the infantry commander?
It depends whether it's an infantry heavy or an armoured heavy battle group. And that just sets it over naturally.
You mentioned 432 bogging in an incident. What was it like at covering rough ground? What sort of ground would you consider prohibited
well,
use?
You needed to be able to read the ground before you were able to go to certain ground. And I think we're talking about 14 tons, the 42, I think. And there was plenty of bogging in Northwest Germany. When you go into that, you want to be cool out. And a couple of vehicles were probably way back in short supply. So you need to be down there carefully. And they used to get bogged down on occasion. Not often, but the tanks used to be much more back to the
They're heavier, aren't they?
40 tons, 50 tons.
What sort of country would you consider prohibited use of such vehicles? For example, would you consider it unwise to use them in woodland or any other sort of close terrain?
You obviously take much greater caution about how you proceed in the world than in open country. And in a way, unless you want to create surprise by going through with them to get out on a flank and take a risk on it, then you need to carry out reconnaissance rapidly with some form of armored vehicle to test the ground before you put in the rather more vulnerable, soft air 432s. But they need to be right up there to shift the vehicle. So there's always a risk, and this is why intelligence is so important, tactical intelligence. That's how you get it. Come back to the whole orchestra in armored warfare. It has to understand what they're effectively.
And you say this is fluid, but presumably you had training in battle drills and station keeping for this kind of operation. Let's suppose you were doing an advance to contact and you got one platoon forward and two back in order to go around the flanks. And that's not something that would happen naturally unless it had been practiced and reduced to procedure.
Absolutely. A lot of this can be in orders can be cut down to almost sort of a shorthand. But you have to be quite careful. It's very slick and, peacetime, extremely slick. And be one of the things that, very suspicious about. Because along the line, some of the officers became extremely slick. And with a tremendous chat and so on. But one wondered how deep the professionalism was, how much of it was chat. You know, and underneath